You're listening to the World Affairs Podcast. We're bringing you new perspectives, global stories, and conversations that matter. I'm Jane Wales. I'll be your host. The story begins right here in San Francisco. In fact, it begins just 20 feet below my desk. In February, a LinkedIn employee rode BART into the city. He was headed to have dinner at the restaurant that's just downstairs from our offices. Generally, this would simply be an account of an evening out, but it was later learned that this individual was sick with the measles. Now imagine if instead of a local train ride, this had been an international flight. The ease of international travel has vastly accelerated the speed with which diseases spread. We'll explore what health professionals, governments, business leaders, and philanthropists are doing to stem disease transmission. And we'll consider how we can each contribute to the prevention of the next pandemic. Today on World Affairs, we're looking at diseases, how they spread, how they're contained, how they're cured, and we'll look at how sometimes they surprise us by returning long after we think they're gone. To understand more about this recent measles episode, we spoke to Adam Crowley. He's an epidemiologist who works to detect the first signals of a disease outbreak. We also spoke to Alex Caroli. He's a Bay Area resident who decided to take his family on vacation to Disneyland.
There are a lot of people along the way who are kind of saying that, well, we have it under control and that's good enough. But that's sort of short-term thinking. You really need to think long-term. My name's Adam Crowley. I'm a research associate with the SCOLE Global Threats Fund here in San Francisco. So my role is working with our pandemics team. Our focus is really on disease surveillance and really detecting those first signals of an outbreak. Every time we have a case of measles or pertussis or a lot of other diseases, they all fall under a list of what are considered mandatory reportable diseases, meaning, you know, doctors that encounter them have to report to health departments. They get reported all the way up to CDC. And in most cases, the local health departments are obligated to conduct what they call a case in contact investigation, meaning you have this person with a case of measles. And because measles is so incredibly contagious, you have to do a follow-up with every potential person that they might have transmitted that virus to. And for some diseases, that's fairly simple because it's challenging to actually transmit some. But with measles, it's insane, honestly, how big some of these contact investigations can be. I think in the United States, we've seen a big resurgence of both pertussis, or whooping cough, as a lot of people know it, as well as measles. And we've obviously had this very recent measles outbreak linked to Disneyland in California.
There weren't a ton of families coming to us saying, if you go to Disneyland, we're going to boycott you for weeks. But, you know, the one pretty, you know, strong communication, but I'm sure the sentiment was felt by others. My name is Alex Caroli, and I'm Marketing and Communications Director for an environmental nonprofit in San Francisco, and I have a 4.5-year-old daughter named Quinn. My wife, my daughter, and I went to Disneyland, the epicenter of this latest California epidemic. We didn't know when we planned the trip in December that we would, I guess, hit this measles issue kind of front on. So I can tell you when the news of the Disneyland outbreak happened, which I believe was happening like early January, I think when the first few cases were reported, we actually thought, like, you know, what, isn't this funny? How odd that we have this vacation planned. But at first we weren't going to do anything, you know, because we'd gotten the vaccine, you know, in the 70s, and Quinn was, you know, it wasn't even a thought because she had, you know, kind of the double dose, and you know, that there was 0% chance. So it didn't really concern us. What you have to remember is it's not just the child, but it's other people's children and actually other people's family members. As we started to kind of clue in to what one of us getting it could have done kind of to our local community, if you will, our you know, set of friends that we have where we live, it took on a kind of a heightened importance to us. We know that we were directly told from at least one family that they wouldn't be in contact with us for 2 weeks, the incubation period, 2 weeks after we got back from Disneyland because they have a young child, another young child, under the age of, I think, definitely under the age of two in their household. So they didn't want any, especially with the measles, because it's, you know, very airborne and it can be quite contagious.
I mean, honestly, we live in a society where we have the luxury to worry more about the vaccines and the medications that we're taking than we have to worry about the actual disease that they're designed to prevent and treat. So it's hard to reconcile, I think. But, you know, getting those vaccinations is really key to stopping these outbreaks.
What happens when a disease has been dormant for a long time, when its memory is so distant that we begin to question the vaccine that's protected us all these years? I spoke to Larry Brilliant. He's an epidemiologist and he's former president of the SCOAL Global Threats Fund. In his early career, he worked on the World Health Organization's smallpox eradication campaign. I asked him to take us from California to West Africa, the location of the largest Ebola epidemic in history.
All the wealth, all the power, whether it is in Silicon Valley today or is in royalty in the 15th, 16th century, didn't stop you from dying from a disease for which there were no vaccine, no antivirals, and no understanding of its transmission. Then it was smallpox, now it's swine flu or SARS or MERS or any of the panoply of new pandemic potential viruses that we encounter. It's important to know Ebola is not one of those things. Ebola has a life cycle. It's usually 100 or 200 cases. It used to be thought to have an 80 or 90% case fatality rate. One thing we've learned for sure is with good medical care, with adequate nutrition, with intravenous fluids, and with kind of Western medicine, that case fatality rate should be around 20%, not 90%. So it's a bad virus and a lack of medical care.
Then there's the impact of urbanization and mobile populations. They accelerate the speed and scale of contagion. They also highlight the differences in response to outbreaks. Why was it that Nigeria was able to contain the disease when Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone could not?
So when the spark of Ebola got on an airplane in Monrovia and went into Lagos, then it landed in a more developed country. But that's not the reason that it didn't catch fire. The reason it didn't catch fire is they had hundreds of thousands of polio eradication workers, surveillance workers who'd been trained in how to do early detection and early response. That's the mantra of how you stop an infectious disease, an outbreak, or a pandemic. Early detection, early and adequate response. These polio workers, it was nothing for them to do exactly what you should do. Find the first cases, put a ring of isolation around them, quarantining them in effect. And so we had 9 cases. I mean, I don't know if we'd have had as few cases if that spark had come to my hometown of Detroit, Michigan.
Governing and healthcare institutions have an obvious role to play, and so do commercial actors, businesses.
My name is Peter Robertson, and I'm retired 6 years ago from Chevron. I was the vice chairman of the board of directors of Chevron Corporation. You want your employees to be healthy. In order for them to be healthy, their families have to be healthy. And so pretty soon you find yourself spending a lot of time, you know, thinking about education in the community, health in the community. In my experience, the work that we did was more related to the communities where we have some employees. What a company like Chevron, but most other companies too, worry about is if you're going to have an operation, it could be a refinery, could be an oil field, could be a solar farm, could be a wind farm, could be all kinds of different things. You rely on the local community for a lot of things. You rely on the local community for employees. You rely on the employees rely on their families. And you rely on the local community to give you the right to be there.
What is the role of private philanthropy, given its agility, its ability to act fast and connect the dots? I asked Larry to comment.
I look at what Bill and Melinda Gates have done. In the 70s, only 20% of kids were vaccinated against these childhood diseases. And today, it's not one-fifth, it's four-fifths. 80% of children are vaccinated, 20% are not vaccinated. And I think it wasn't the government, it wasn't WHO, it was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that's responsible for flipping that ratio. And if you cut through all of the complexity of what a philanthropy can do, the Gates Foundation flipped that ratio. They moved the death rate in kids from as much as half of the children under the age of 5 dying to less than 1 in 10. I think that the role for private philanthropy on these big issues is enormous. Now it's a chance to do it not as one foundation, but, you know, working together with other organizations in a collegial way, adding science, philanthropy, activist NGOs, governments, and United Nations agencies. It's a different world now. We have a chance to do some amazing things.
We're all driving toward the same goal, but from different perspectives. For a company, it's about healthy employees, healthy communities. For an individual doctor, it's about each life saved. And for an epidemiologist, well, it's about the health of populations that span the globe. So let's hear once more from Adam of the Skoll Global Threats Fund.
As an epidemiologist, you tend to be working at a population level with data, and so you don't get as much of that one-on-one interaction the way a doctor might have with a patient. But when you can look and quantify and really start to understand the effect that different policies and interventions are having at a population level, you can see, like, wow, you know, we didn't just save one person today. Like, we may have prevented 100 people from, you know, catching a disease because they got vaccinated today. So I think it you need to stretch your imagination a little bit to grasp that sometimes. And, you know, the bad days are the days where you struggle to keep that in mind. But I think overall, that gives me a lot of motivation, and there's nothing I'd rather be doing.
That's all for this episode of the World Affairs Podcast. We hope you'll keep the conversation going. Share this episode or become part of the conversation. Visit worldaffairs.org to add your voice, your perspective. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for listening.